Welcome to the Empirical Cycling Podcast. I'm your host, Coley Moore, joined as always by my co-host, Kyle Helson. And I want to thank everybody for listening as always and ask that you subscribe to the podcast if you haven't, and especially share it with a friend if you like what we're doing here. If you would be so kind as to give us an iTunes rating, 5 stars never goes amiss. And also, we are an ad-free podcast. So if you want to donate to the show, you can do so at empiricalcycling.com/donate. We have the show notes up on the website, and actually this time we're going to put all the questions up. And then we've also got merch at empiricalcyclingpodcast.threadless.com. And if you have any coaching and consultation inquiries, questions, and comments, email me at empiricalcycling@gmail.com. And also, we have Instagram AMAs on the weekends. Just finished the Saturday one as of recording. So give me a follow over there at empiricalcycling if you want to participate in that. And that's where we got all of the questions for this. So I've been doing it for a couple months now, I think almost six. And so I wanted to do a best of 2020 Instagram questions, and then we'll do another one for 2021. So this is just a selection of the things that I thought were really, really interesting that made me go, oh, yeah, that's a good question. That might need some explaining to some folks. And, you know, hopefully I've got the right answer. So let's get started. Actually, unless you want to add anything, Kyle.
No, I think this is fun. God, 2020 is almost over. It's nice. It's nice.
It is nice. Oh. Nothing's going to change in 2021. Don't worry.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Good. So I asked, I also asked on Instagram for people to submit questions for this, something particularly philosophical or, you know, big picture, something like that. We got a couple good ones. So we're going to include a couple of those as well. So the first one being, what was the most pivotal moment where your, parenthetically, you, Coley, philosophy around coaching changed? What precipitated the change, and why did it make such an impact, and how did these create different results for your athletes? It actually started with getting invited to do a webinar for WKO4. When Tim Cusick asked me to do something on sprint training, I said yes. And it was also around that time that I was getting a lot of inquiries for consultations from people who I looked up to. And that's when I started thinking, maybe I know stuff that other people generally don't. It's not to say that everybody doesn't know things. Obviously, I learned all these things from somewhere. In the coaching world, it seemed to me that I had a unique perspective, possibly. And that actually made me a little more confident in what I knew. But at the same time, it actually made me question everything I knew, because every time I get a little bit of self-confidence, I get like 3 times as much self-doubt. Imposter syndrome is very real over here. And that's actually what helped me become a better coach, is, you know, realizing that I'm not entirely sure about everything I know. And it made me work really, really hard to learn more about why I think I know what I know, if that makes any sense. And I'm sure, actually, it's like that for you in physics, Kyle, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think most people actually who have had any sort of academic preparation or background kind of get that feeling of, like, you have this early on, you think, oh, like, I know some good stuff, and I feel like I got a good handle on it. And then all of a sudden, you start learning more, and then you become less sure because your awareness of all of the other stuff that's out there kind of makes you doubt everything that you've learned up to that point. And it's kind of this weird back and forth, I think, for a lot of people, where, like, you are never done learning ever. And part of that is because the more you learn, the more you become aware of all there is out there, and how much you also become aware of what you don't know about is just even more so than you're aware of what you do know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in the middle of reading a review paper, actually not even in the middle. I'm in the first like quarter of reading a review paper, for the next series of episodes. And there are several hundred references, and it is really apparent just how much you don't know when you're reading a review paper from somebody who's been in, you know, this very, very small niche of this field for, you know, his or her entire life. And, you know, I'm on page like 3, And the references are already in the like low hundreds.
Sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm just reading this going, wow, there is so much out there that I will never have a chance to really know. And it's hard to, you know, prioritize, like you were talking about in the last 10-minute tips episode, chasing the references. And you mentioned that it gets into being a pretty deep rabbit hole really quick, and it certainly can. And learning to prioritize that is, well, it's an ever-present struggle, we should say.
For sure. And I think that's something you get better at, obviously, as you get a bigger and broader background. You become more aware of, okay, I need to track this down because I know that I am deficient in this area, whereas this area I don't need to chase down as much because I built up a little bit more background knowledge there. So you get better at picking your battles and being like, oh, okay, yeah, okay, I have to go spend, you know, I know this is going to take me 4 hours of digging to go find, you know.
No, exactly. Sometimes it takes me like a week to read a paper because I have to read 9 other papers to get sufficient background on it. And, you know, it's like you were talking about again, reading the intro and chasing down some of the references and kind of, you know, starting to build this framework in your mind of how things fit together. It's, it can take some time. And if you're getting good at it, you can skim an intro section and go, all right, I got this. I'm going to go right to the methods.
Yeah. But it takes years. Like, yeah. You know, I certainly, even when I was doing my PhD, like it took me 2-3 years of, you know, kind of being immersed in a field before I could do that, to papers that were written by like people who were doing almost the exact same thing as me, right? So now if you're going to go look at papers from people who are doing things that you don't have the foundational knowledge in, like, geez, you know, not that it's going to take you 3 years of full-time study to do it, but it's going to take you a while, you know, before you're like, oh, okay, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
Unless you can get, you know, that find that person who can like point you into that direction of this is the one thing that you need to read before you can go, you know.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, I started doing, you know, scientific research on metabolism and exercise and stuff probably 2012 was, you know, when I really, really started digging into it. And it was probably 2016 before I was really comfortable you know, just reading an average exercise physiology paper, and also starting to be sometimes disappointed by them. So that's another way that you can tell that you're kind of getting into a field. Anyway, so yeah, it was so it was really that moment of you know, confidence followed by the what would you call it? Overshot kind of stuff. Like in there's a bunch of physiological examples where you stop doing a thing and then suddenly the concentration of something just shoots up for a minute before the regulation catches it and brings it back down. So that's what I feel like it was, like a little confidence and then like, oh no, I don't know anything.
Yeah. You feel like it's just coming together and then, oh no.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah. But that's really common. So, you know, definitely should not feel like that's a bad or there's something wrong with you, you know?
No, definitely. And I mean, a lot of my athletes have actually asked me, you know, how come we're not doing the same thing that we did last year? And it's because, well, that was last year. And I think we can get better adaptations with less, you know, fatigue acquired. So we're really paring down the work into what matters. And, you know, sometimes it takes a couple of years to really, really figure out, what works for a particular athlete, or sometimes it's just, you know, something you learn with one or two people, you can apply pretty widely. So, takes a lot of thought, and it's, I think Tim Cusick in one of his recent webinars said it's an iterative process, and I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Lots of things in science are iterative.
Yes. Everything, actually. All right. So question two, what is the most overlooked low-hanging fruit training? So there's a second part to this question. So let's get to this. I think it's actually rest and sleep.
I was going to say, I like that. I like rest and sleep because those are almost not training. But I was going to go in and like, be kind of, I don't know what's the right word.
Flippant.
Yeah, kind of stupid. No, it's kind of. I was gonna be that guy and say like, doing something like stretching or something where, like, because even though stretching feels dumb because you're working on mobility or something like that, you're like, oh, this isn't gonna like directly make me faster. It often makes you feel mentally better the next time you go out to work out. Even if it's just like, oh, I took 10 minutes yesterday and stretched out my legs or my glutes or my hips or whatever. But today, now I feel way better. Just, you know, almost without thinking about it, it is just entirely mental. And that's fine because, you know, placebo effect is real.
Actually, so. I honestly don't think it is entirely mental. Because when you sit around, your muscles and your tendons literally stiffen up. That's why when you see, actually, one of the earliest examples of that kind of thing was in a sprint study, I think in Russia, where a woman got pregnant and stopped training, had her kid and then came back, and she was way faster. One of the reasons for that was because of during periods of inactivity, type 2A muscle fibers turn into type 2X fibers. So, for instance, people without use of their legs are almost entirely type 2X, which seems to be just the fiber type that has the lowest energy cost. You know, if we have to have a muscle here, yeah, we'll do this. But unless you give us a stimulus, we're going to go right to the fastest twitch. But also the other part is the stiffening up of the muscles and tendons. And so when you have time off, or especially with team sports athletes, you know, college athletes, where there's a break and then you come back, everything's really, really stiff, and that makes you faster when you run. But the downside is that it actually increases the chances of injury, because if your tendons are stiffer than your muscle, it'll lead to a muscle tear. So there are a bunch of associated risks with that kind of thing.
That makes sense.
So yeah, so loosening up is literally loosening up your muscle tissue. And yeah, doing a little bit of active recovery can help keep you loose, and it can help, you know, get blood flow to muscles that need some nutrient exchange. I think we talked about that in a Wattstock episode previously. Yeah, I mean, I also thought about just saying, just ride more. but you know, one of the other things to think about here is, you know, on the Instagram questions, I think it was in the Instagram questions, maybe somebody DM'd me about it. It was about, do you assign intervals, you know, besides this one type to RPE? And the answer was, yeah, all the time. And one of the things I think that is powerful for low-hanging fruit in training is thinking more about the expected accumulated fatigue of types of rides and how they should feel, and then working to get to that spot and not focusing on the power numbers so much. Like FTP work, if you do 3x15 and you've got a 40-minute TTE, you know, the last 5 or 10 minutes should probably feel pretty difficult because you're getting out to, you know, your TTE. And if it's a lot harder earlier, then you either got the wrong FTP or you're not recovered yet. And these are, you know, that's one of the things that you can do with, you know, training that I think is actually low-hanging fruit for most people, is kind of changing your mindset to something like that. So, okay, so part two of this question, what is the most hyped marginal gain training? I mean, oh God.
My first instinct or first reaction to this was high intensity intervals, because of all of the reasons that we talked about a couple episodes ago, that you have a lot of very enthusiastic promotions on like social media and things like that about high intensity intervals, and you're like,
blast your glutes with these high intensity kettlebell workouts. I mean, I would say, yeah, but there are also actually very good effects that can be had from high intensity training too. So I wouldn't even say that's a marginal gain. Those are like actual gains depending on what you're looking for. I might say like ice baths.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. Stuff like that, you know, all the things that are supposed to help you recover better. Recovery is, I've probably said this 1,000 times, it's 99% eating and sleeping. And I think, actually, this is one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately, because it's come up talking with a lot of folks in the last couple months, is that I think a lot of cyclists and endurance athletes in general really get used to this general feeling of fatigue, and they hold on to it like a security blanket.
Yeah.
I wish I were being facetious.
No. I'm laughing because that feeling of just like being tired, but being fresh enough to like survive and make it through workouts is the primary training memory I have of like a decade of swimming. Like, you're swimming like 20 plus hours, you know, 20 plus hours a week if you include dry land and lifting and all this stuff. And like, especially when you're in college and you got other stuff to do and you want to have a social life a little bit, like you are like riding that edge of just being tired but not quite being overtrained, like for way too long.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's why I'm saying, you know, all the little things that are supposed to help you recover. I mean, that's where I think, you know, the placebo effect can have a real effect, is if you feel better. And if you're more stressed that you didn't get in your ice bath and compression socks and your space legs, you know, but I mean, space legs is a general term for what are the pants that massage you on the inside? Those things.
Yeah, they're like pneumatic compression massage pants.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, for your legs. Guess what's getting cut out? Anyway, yeah, I think if it stresses you out to miss those things, then it's probably better to just do them. And that's one of those things where the mental aspect of training and recovery can you should think about it, how it relates to yourself. You know what I'm trying to say, right?
Yeah, I think the other thing is, like, for some of these things, if you think that you have to do all of these things, like cupping and like all these weird massage tools and these very expensive $1,000 pants that squeeze your legs for you, and that stresses you out too, like, you can go the other way where, like, you shouldn't have to worry about all of these things. Like, oh, if I don't do this, I'm going to be, you know, completely not recovered for the next time. Like, recovery days or days off also should not stress you out to the point of being worried that you're missing out on something.
Yeah, and if you miss
they shouldn't beat you up. Like, if you come out of a cupping session and you're like bruised all over and you're sore for other for that reason, like, well, that's not going to help you, because you're just sore for a different reason.
Well, I was actually going to say, if you miss your cupping session, it's probably it might behoove you to not look like you were just intimate with a large octopus. All right. So, in the interest of time, moving on. All right. Question three: how important is regular blood testing, and what should you get tested for? That is a great question for an actual doctor. And so I'm going to leave that for your doctor, but I'm actually going to change the question to something I am actually better qualified to answer, which would be, how important is lactate and VO2 max testing and other performance testing that you can test with your blood? If that's what you actually meant by your question, whoever asked this, then I'm sorry, I didn't understand it the first time. So I would actually say doing stuff like that is not important.
Yeah, I agree.
Unless you are a very, very, very highly trained endurance athlete and we need to have good numbers. You know, if you're VO2 max is 90 and WKO5 thinks it's 85, and we're looking at increasing your FTP relative to your VO2 max, or if there's any room to grow there, or how much potential there is to grow, that's one of those things where I need to know what that actual exact number is, as opposed to, you know, getting an estimate that's got, you know, plus or minus 5 to 10%.
Yeah, if it's 60 or 65 or 57, like, meh.
Yeah, exactly. If you're an average amateur, you just watch the power go up, and that's fine. Because, you know, 99% of the things that you want to test for physiologically, we can actually tell pretty well in the power data, excepting a certain margin of error, of course.
Yeah. I would say also there are a lot of times these things require a hefty sum, not like, you know, millions of dollars, but there are probably things you could better spend your money on too.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, actually to blow up my spot a little bit, one of the things that I do want to do up here in Boston eventually is start a center to start testing people. Not because I think the people I coach need to know this information, because, you know, most of the time it, just tracking power data is fine. It's actually because I have a lot of things that I want to look at with regards to, you know, blood lactate and gas exchange and things like that, that I want more data for, because there's very little in the scientific literature for some of the things that I want to look at. So, yeah, so that's one of the reasons I want to do that, but it's not because I think everybody needs to know these things or test it regularly. So, I mean, if you get a VO2 max test once, I mean, that's nice, but what are you going to do with that in the long term? It's not like you can train to your VO2, you know, because you've got to bring your gas exchange meter home now and strap it to your face every time you want to get on the trainer, go for a ride.
Yeah.
Who wants to ride around looking like Bane so in a helmet?
For sure, yeah. I think that you get back to a good point. Like, the whole point of power meters and this thing called functional threshold power is that it's functional and you don't have to drag around an exercise physiology lab with you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you know how to interpret it, it is a pretty decent exercise physiology lab. All right, question four. What is the best single metric to track the short-term regular progression of increased stroke volume? The answer is efficiency factor. So by efficiency factor, I mean what is the normalized power divided by the heart rate. So it's something that you can track with an apples-to-apples kind of ride comparison, where let's say you're doing endurance rides, you're either going to power or RPE or heart rate. You can track over a couple weeks if your efficiency factor is going up. But also, I just like to track efficiency factor in the big picture anyway, just to look at, you know, a couple months or a whole season for somebody and see if it's going up or if it's, you know, staying flat. You know, is that the intent? Should we, modify the training, something like that? That's how I would do it. Question five, where does fat oxidation during cycling originate? Is it the closest fat cell? Now, this is a great question because this gets to one of the most misunderstood things. We're actually going to get a lot into this in the next Wattstock series on metabolism. Fat oxidation during cycling originates in the whole body adipose tissue and also in the actual muscles' fat stores. So your muscles, your trained muscles in your legs, actually have their own fat stores called intramuscular triglycerides, IMTGs. And the same signal that tells your whole body fat stores to mobilize fat into your bloodstream for use and oxidation is the same one that tells your muscles to do the same. And, you know, there are actually studies out there that show when you mobilize fatty acids from other tissues, it actually is preferentially used as opposed to intramuscular triglycerides, and it also reduces the glycogen utilization as well. It can actually be the closest fat cell if you have a fat cell that is upstream from that same blood vessel. I can't imagine this is very common at all. But, you know, Kyle, where do you think something like this originated from? Do you think it's like if you do crunches, your abs will show through? And that means people think that you're burning belly fat, but in actuality, it's just because your muscles are getting bigger so you can see them?
Yeah, for sure. I think the whole, like, spot training myth has been a very popular trope in, you know, infomercial-related fitness products for years, where, like, oh, if you just wear this, like, EMG ab belt or whatever, or you know, EMS ab belt, where, oh, it'll, like, stimulate your ab muscles for you, and then in 10 weeks you'll have a six-pack or something. Like, well, no. or I don't know, or other various things where, like, oh, look, this person using this product, like, you know, lost a bunch of weight, and now you can see their abs. Well, but they also went on a diet and did other things.
You know? Yeah. Like, yeah, the signal that makes you mobilize fat to lose it from storage is systemic. It's through your whole body. Like, you don't send this signal into your bloodstream to have it, you know, only go to your belly fat. Like, you literally cannot direct it like that. So it just goes everywhere.
That's also why when people gain and lose weight, different people gain and lose weight in different places. Like, some people, you know, it's around their midsection or on their arms or their legs or their face or wherever. And like, there's no way that you can predict that aside from having done it before, where you'll lose weight first or last or whatever.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Question 6, is it true that becoming more fat adapted slows your body's ability to use carbs? The answer is yes. And also no. Okay, so let's get into this. There's really two ways that I think quote-unquote fat adaptation might be interpreted. So let's go with the normal training way first. So training fat adaptation is not going to be detrimental. It is not going to affect your ability to use carbohydrates for high-power efforts. I really need to stress that. Now, what's really happening is training gets your body to mobilize fatty acids when you are training. But because you are still eating a normal carbohydrate thing and you are still telling your body that you need to use it through sprint efforts and sprint training and stuff like that, your body is going to be able to be flexible enough to have both pathways as needed. So, you know, you need to sprint, it's going to go, okay, we need a lot of carbohydrates. But if you're doing a long endurance ride, then it's going to say, okay, we need to mobilize and use fatty acids. And you can have that kind of thing going on. However, if you are going to be dieting, changing your diet to change your quote-unquote fat adaptation, I would say you're actually not actually fat adapting by changing your diet. So low-carb, high-fat, keto kind of stuff, this is actually going to introduce a lot more fats into your bloodstream through your gut, through your diet, so you are not actually having to mobilize them from your adipose tissue. So this is a big distinction. And this is the kind of thing that will, in fact, affect your body's ability to burn carbohydrates, because you're telling your body, we don't have much coming in. The liver cannot actually make that much that rapidly. And so we really need to temper our carbohydrate use because of how our diet looks. And, you know, does the diet actually mean that you are mobilizing more of your own fats? No, not necessarily. You know, when you are doing this kind of diet, the reason that people most people would lose body fat is because they're actually eating less food and less calories, and so your body is in an energetic deficit. Your body is a great energy accountant, and so really, it's not going to necessarily get your body to mobilize fats better unless you are in an energy a state of deficit. So that's really the important distinction here. So if you are thinking that your training is going to affect your ability to use carbohydrates, just train normally, train for endurance and train for sprints, and do your normal thing, do your periodization, everything's going to be fine. But if you're going to look at something like changing your diet for fat adaptation, I would actually advise strongly that you don't. Okay. Question 7, discuss balance between lactate production and combustion, parenthetically aerobic and anaerobic. Wow, this is a very large can of worms. So here's the, and this is how you know we've done no prep for this show. Here's the short answer that's going to be long. Almost all forms of metabolism are actually anaerobic. And we're going to have a very clickbaity title on that coming up as probably our next Watts Talk episode. But just because something produces lactate doesn't mean it is anaerobic. In muscles, lactate is pretty much the main product of glycolysis, and then it eventually, if you are at a certain level of you know, energy requirements. It'll go into the mitochondria and become pyruvate and get oxidized regardless. So just because you're producing lactate doesn't mean that anything is anaerobic necessarily. A lot of pathways are functionally without oxygen, including, for instance, the Krebs cycle. If you look at the Krebs cycle, there's no oxygen anywhere. You're off-gassing CO2, but you are... Well, we're going to get into that.
And we talked about this a little bit in Wattstock 17 on why we make lactate, and that lactate is not just an indicator that you're working anaerobically.
Yeah.
Or, well, what is traditionally referred to as anaerobically before.
Yeah, and so there's actually a lot more to this question that I would want to ask the person who asked it about, you know, what is their understanding of aerobic and anaerobic. So... So we actually have a lot of dimensions to this question that need to be explored, and we're going to be doing that in the next series on metabolism. We're going to start with fat metabolism, actually, and then we'll probably get into some of this. And also, I know I'm going to get 1,000 questions on lactate coming up in the next couple weeks because there's a project coming out with WKO5 very soon that I'm excited about, but I'm also dreading a little bit for this reason. all right, so I think it's time to move on to question 8. How long does a sweet spot interval need to be relative to FTP TTE for maximum effectiveness? So to rephrase that question, if your FTP can be held for, let's say, 45 minutes, how long does a sweet spot interval need to be effective? The answer is it depends how long you can hold sweet spot. So if you can hold FTP for 45 minutes and you can only hold a sweet spot for an hour, then I would say you probably need to start with an hour worth of intervals. Maybe 15 minutes, something like that. But if you can hold sweet spot for an hour and a half, then I'd say you need to start with about 80, 90 minutes worth of intervals. Even if your TTE at FTP is only 45 minutes.
Yeah. And note that is total interval time, not necessarily continuous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that enables us to do work with FTP and sweet spot intervals and stuff like that, because rest intervals allow us to do more actual work at this particular intensity. But if we are fatigued a little bit, it means, let's say you just did a hard FTP workout the day before and now you have sweet spot intervals. If you tried to do one sweet spot interval, you'd probably get like 75 to 80% of the way to TTE at 90% FTP. But if you take some breaks, you can probably get out to 90 minutes, something like that. It's one of those things where it's also personal. So you don't want to be, you know, getting to a true Olympics 10 out of 10. If there were like a sweet spot Olympics, every 4 years, like they should include sweet spot Olympics. They've got breakdancing now, so we should,
I mean, isn't that's basically what Zwift is, right?
Depends, on, I guess. Yeah, so you don't want to be getting that true 10 out of 10, I'm dying at the end of my sweet spot intervals every day. You want to get pretty close. You want to feel like you're working hard and that it's hard for the last maybe 10 or 15 minutes, but not absolutely impossible. You just feel like you're working. And that's a pretty good goal for knowing that you've done about the right amount and that you'll be able to do more next time.
Yeah. The whole point is not to bury yourself so much that you are incapable of moving the next day.
Absolutely. No matter how good you feel with your fatigue security blanket. All right.
I just print my PMC from WKO5 and sleep with it on top of me. Oh, it feels so nice.
All right, question 9. Effect of increased muscle mass on FTP / VO2, for simplicity, all other things equal. If you increase your muscle mass, I would, without anything else changing, actually depends. Now, there is actually one factor that we'll have to think about. I know. I'm so sorry. Because if you grow your muscle fibers, or if you add muscle fibers, for instance, if we're looking at the same number of muscle capillaries or the same density of muscle capillaries, I'm actually going to go with this is going to be the same number of muscle capillaries, because without a ton of endurance training, you're going to keep the same number, most likely. Is that FTP relative to VO2 max is actually going to go down.
Yeah.
So that is a thing to think about when you're doing long-term stuff, but it's not going to go down like 20 or 30 watts unless you abandon completely all endurance training whatsoever.
Yeah. And if you think about it too, we talked a little bit about how muscle mass plays a role in VO2 max in our VO2 max series. So
yeah, because it's more tissue to service. Although when you have, when you have a lot of muscle mass, it's more tissue to surface, but also it's, it distributes the load, or it can distribute the load. Well, it depends on force requirements. Oh my God, it's getting into a fucking rabbit hole.
yeah. Anyway, it depends kind of.
So. Yeah. Yeah. So the answer is it depends. If you need to put on muscle mass for various reasons, like you need to get better at attacking. If you're very slim and you don't have a good peak power, putting on muscle mass is going to help make power. It's going to help with high force efforts, like low cadence coming out of corners and stuff like that, getting over obstacles on single track, things like that. Or if you need to improve your start in cyclocross or short track or cross country or whatever it is, that's
BMX. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of those things where, like, if you don't get a good start, you can spend the whole race fighting back for 30th place. But if you get a good start and you're in the top 10, you can stay in the top 10. So that's one of those times when you might say, all right, losing 5 or 10 watts off my FTP, if it is that, that's going to be worth me actually having a better start. So there are trade-offs and there are things to think about with that. All right, question 10. What is the minimum time in zone 22? That's a typo. What is the minimum time in zone 2 to promote adaptation? Wow, that's a question. More than you're currently doing.
Right, yeah. I mean, if progressive overload is a is a philosophy of periodization, then yeah, doing more is better. But yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's one of those things where I've always had a hard time expressing really what is the heart of progressive overload, and especially in relation to endurance performance. Because, you know, I always say that you don't want to be too tired at the end of a zone 2 ride. You don't want to accumulate that much fatigue. And so you want to keep it sustainable. And then a lot of people, I think, associate being completely out of gas with adaptation. And that's something that I've seen in a lot of consults, actually. So it's not an assumption. It's something that I've had to advise people on quite frequently. So it seems like maybe if you are not killing yourself on a ride, then, you know, if you end up after a 4-hour ride feeling about the same as after a 6-hour ride, then is a 4-hour ride just the same? No, the answer is the 6-hour ride is better for adaptation. But if you're used to riding, for instance, 12 to 15 hours a week, if you ever get a chance to bump up that volume, you really want to take it. And the more you can do, the better. So if you get like a week off from work or something like that, just go ride as much as you can and then recover. And you will see some improvements after you've fully recovered.
Yeah.
Question 11. Is there any significant difference in doing zone 2 at the top versus bottom of your quote-unquote zone? I must have put this here on purpose because we were just kind of getting at that. You don't want to accumulate too much fatigue with zone 2 stuff. Which is why I always assign it as RPE instead of watts based. And this actually ties in with the training philosophy earlier, low hanging fruit for training stuff. Not associating a certain power output with zone 2. Because I remember when I used to go out and I would ride right at the top of zone two, like a watt below zone three. I was like, yeah, I'm doing endurance training. Wow, this is really hard after a little while. Oh my God, right. What am I doing? It's not nearly as effective as pacing it sustainably. And for a lot of folks, you know, endurance training, endurance riding will fall into the typical quote unquote zone two. For some folks, it can actually be a lot higher. It can be as high as, you know, low 80s, like 80, 82, 85% FTP, something like that, that you can just motor at all day without accumulating too much fatigue. Maybe 85 is a bit high, but I think the highest of anybody I'm training right now is probably 80% FTP, 82, where they can really do like a 7-hour ride and feel mostly okay afterwards. So it depends where you're at. And if doing 70% leads to too much fatigue, then you're going to want to, you know, bump it down to 65. And always start easier than you think you need to and kind of let yourself work into it. And we'll actually get into the hormonal regulations of why that is in the next couple episodes. So, yeah.
I would say the other thing is keep in mind that, like you said, if you do start off a little easy, it's not like if you start off a little bit easy, you're going to get nothing out of it. It's not like you're just going to waste that 3 hours. Like,
yeah,
you still get benefits, and it might be hard to say like, oh, this is this. Oh, if you go up a little bit in the zone, it's going to be 8% better than if you're a little bit down in the, it, you know, it's not nearly that exact of a science. So don't worry if, for whatever reason, you have to start off a little easy and ease into it. And then if, you know, an hour in, you're like, oh, I actually feel pretty good. I'm going to go a little bit harder. Okay, great. You know.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it was in the that Wattstock episode on pacing endurance rides. What was that, 14 or 15?
15.
15. I think I said something like you should not accumulate that much extra fatigue just going for another 10 watts. Because that extra 10 watts is not going to get you that much adaptation, but it's going to get you a lot more fatigue. And it's not worth chasing it.
Or for some people, that's going to be mentally very difficult too. Yeah. Where they're going to be, they have a comfortable power that they could cruise at for 2.5 hours, or if they're going to try to bump it up 10 or 15 watts, they're going to be just fixated on their computer, like incapable of focusing on anything else. They're like, well, that's mentally also exhausting. If you're like, oh God,
yeah, know. It is. Yeah. Like whenever I know that one of my athletes needs to go out and do a bunch of volume, but I figure they're probably going to be mentally tired, I won't even write endurance ride. I'll write something like tourist ride. Just, and I'll literally say, look at the trees, stop for pictures, get a coffee.
Like tape over the computer, just go. Just like ride your bike.
Yeah, yeah. Put your computer in your pockets. You know, just watch what time of day it is. Watch how long you've been out, and that's it. And we actually folded in the next question, number 12. What percentage of FTP do you consider zone 2, and how important to stay in range when training it? So we already answered that. Question 13, how to keep my strength gains achieved this off season while shifting priorities to cycling? This is a really good question that I get asked very frequently, so I figure it's probably good to include here. Kyle, I know you know the answer to this. Why don't you go ahead?
Well, I think if you can stay in contact at least a little bit with some sort of strength or resistance training while you shift your priorities to racing, that is the best way. There are some things, if you don't have access to weights or to equipment or something like that, there are substitutes that you can do. But we talked about this in Wattstock 5, I think, that like if you need that high strength, low rev, high force production, you have to actually do this maybe once a week or something like that while you're actually still focusing on racing.
Yeah, and you have to watch out for the fatigue and everything, because there is definitely an associated fatigue. And usually within probably 2 weeks of a really high priority race, I don't like people in the gym unless they're a sprinter. So there's some give and take. And it depends on if somebody needs that neural activation and whatnot. So, but generally, I would also add that if you are not in the gym, if you find it's too much fatigue, but you want to keep that muscle mass that you've worked so hard for, I would advise that you, first of all, don't diet too hard. If you drop weight too fast, your body's going to lose fat and muscle. But if you maintain your, especially maintain your protein intake, that's going to be really, really beneficial for keeping your muscle mass as much as possible, because muscle mass is not one of the body's priorities exactly when it comes to things to maintain, because you've got a lot of other tissues absolutely necessary for life, and then muscle mass is a priority so you can move around and stuff. But you know, that's why to get bigger past a certain point, bodybuilders need to use steroids. Because bodies just aren't meant to have them.
In honor of Mr. Olympia, just having been this yesterday, this past week. Yeah, those guys are huge, and those girls are huge because they are using extra non-naturally sourced hormones.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and also doing a little bit of sprint work, stuff like that, can help maintain muscle mass as well, because just making sure that as much muscle mass as you can activate is being activated occasionally helps maintain it. So really, if you want a short answer, it's keep up the protein, 1.5 grams per kilogram body weight per day, and do some sprinting maybe once a week. And if you can get into the gym and do some couple submaximal reps of like squats or deadlifts at like, you know, 75, 80%, sometimes even 65, 70% is enough to maintain muscle mass. Just see what works and see what doesn't add too much fatigue, and it'll be actually pretty easy to fold into your program.
Yeah, I think keep in mind that's a good point. Like, you don't have to go in and do like a just absolutely brutal strength workout to maintain what you've already built. You don't have to like bury yourself in like high volume, you know, 10 sets of 10 squats or something.
Oh.
And actually, please don't do that. Like almost ever.
No, don't do that. A couple of my athletes who were doing maintenance lifting last year, it was pretty much once a week, a couple sets of 3 to 5 for squats and single leg stuff. And really submaximal, just enough to make you work a little bit, but
I would think it almost could feel like openers, where you do it and you leave feeling pretty good and feel like you had got a good effort in, but you're not exhausted, right? Like, oh, I got some good tension in and force, and I can feel that like my legs were working good, you know. I can go home
actually,
and I can
sleep
well.
That's a really good way to think about that too, because with, like we talked about earlier, with muscles getting too stiff, doing a little bit of kind of slower, heavy lifting may be beneficial with, keeping your muscles from getting too stiff. Because I know that's what a lot of, for instance, really, really experienced football players and team athletes will do, is they go into the weight room and instead of doing, you know, their early career type really fast lifting, sprinting, cleans and stuff like that, they'll just go in there and lift heavy weights real slow because they're trying to keep their muscles from getting too stiff.
Yeah.
All right, so question 14, aerobic equals long, but also short and hard for 4 to 7 minutes above anaerobic threshold equals max aerobic. How? So let's parse this question. So this person is asking, why is aerobic long and short, but also VO2 max is also aerobic?
Well, I think one thing in there, it's an anaerobic threshold. There are these all sorts of different things that people like to call thresholds. Which is, oh boy, they're unfortunately all similarly named, and they all can mean different things depending on who's using that term, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it depends on how you measure it too, because if you measure it from a ramp test, for instance, it can way underestimate and blah, blah, blah. One of the worst, actually, ramp tests with lactate I've ever seen underestimated this athlete's FTP or maximal lactate steady state by about 60 watts.
Nice. Yeah.
Anyway, anaerobic threshold is a bad term because, you know, even when you're at threshold, you know, you do have some glycolytic flux, which means you are operating anaerobically, but also maybe burning fat is anaerobic. Stay tuned. Dun, dun, dun.
I think the other thing is that it's not like once you hit 1 watt over FTP, you instantly like click over and you're all anaerobic. Like all of these systems operate on a continuum. So to think that, oh, I hit my anaerobic threshold, I must be working all anaerobically or all aerobic, aerobically.
Yeah, that's one of those things where if you overinterpret a name that has historical inertia like anaerobic threshold, it's going to lead you astray if you take it too literally. But at the same time, that is one of the reasons that it was named that, because that was one of the things that they thought might be happening. Oh, there's a lot of lactate. It must be anaerobic because, that if you listen to our Lactate Myths and Truths episode, you will hear a lot more about that. So yeah, basically what happens is at FTP, FTP is basically the ceiling of being able to supply your energy for the most part aerobically. The reason why there's a lot of lactate produced at FTP and just a little below FTP is because there's not enough fat oxidation. It's not happening quickly enough to fully supply it. But you know, if you are on the keto diet, you're going to see gas exchange. You're going to see fat oxidation go up at FTP quite a lot because your body's just getting better at using it and moving it. So at threshold, to me, that's like the highest ceiling of sustainable aerobic load, the glycolytic contribution. And once you start going over that, now this gets into the nature of FTP, and I don't want to scoop myself on this, but basically what happens is something happens and you cannot supply the ATP rapidly enough. So glycolysis starts to fill in. And that's why we get a big bump in lactate right there. And that doesn't mean that you cannot use more aerobic energy. It's just that something is happening where you cannot increase your aerobic contribution as much as your energy requirements demand. Yeah. So glycolysis helps cover the over.
And you can think about it this way too, like especially for typically for well-trained endurance cyclists, you know, crit racers, things like that, like a roughly 1 minute, 60 second effort kind of represents a duration where about 50-50, you have completely, we'll say, quote, anaerobic contributions to your energy source and then 50% aerobic contributions. So at that 4, 5, 6 minute, whatever people want to normally think of being as VO2 max, you're still providing a bulk of the energy via these aerobic processes.
Yeah, and to clarify, you mean at the 1 minute marker from like a full sprint?
Yeah. If you do a 1 minute all out,
the first couple seconds are always entirely fully anaerobic, and then it becomes gradually more aerobic as your system starts to deliver oxygen. And this is one of the things we got into in the VO2 max series, is that your heart and your vasculature, your cardiovascular system, is really one of the big limiters of O2. Transport, and your body's going to use it if it's there. So it's not a utilization really shortcoming as much as it is a transport. So if you make your heart bigger, then you'll have higher VO2 max and you can supply more energy aerobically. How cool is that? All right, I think we beat this one to death. So question 15, is there any truth to the endo-meso-ectomorph stuff? No. Question 16. All right, let's get into this. Kyle, why don't you kick us off?
I think these are three. So for people who are unfamiliar, endomorph, mesomorph, ectomorph were these also kind of bro science-y terms for people who have some sort of general body shape and then where they store fat. But then also it had to do with, oh, maybe if you're this one type, you're better at this kind of sports or this other kind of sports or this diet or that diet or this style of training is going to be better. And like people like to associate a lot of these things with, oh, there must be this like certain type of body that wants this more, and that somehow based on phenotypes, just like looking at yourself in a mirror, you'd be able to determine what type of training or what type of diet or what type of sports you would be good at.
Yeah. And it's crap. Yeah. There's really absolutely nothing to it. you know, because a lot of it is based on your bone structure and how much muscle you naturally have. Like, what is your body's sort of like stasis amount of muscle and body fat and bone structure? And that kind of makes you an endomeso or ectomorph.
But that doesn't tell you about what fiber types you're packing or how big your heart is or all these
things. Yeah, it doesn't tell you how quickly your brain can activate your muscle fibers, which is a big component of sprinting. So just because somebody's big doesn't mean they can make a lot of watts.
Right, yeah.
Like, for instance, Kyle can outlift me in the gym, but I can outsprint him on the bike. So there's a lot more to it. Yeah, and I used to be a mesomorph, and now I'm more ectomorphic. thanks, burritos.
Yeah. I think the other thing is, like, you also see people who, like, okay, so generally people want to say, oh, well, road cyclists, climbers, right? They're skinny, these tiny little, like, wayfish people who can't put suitcases in overhead bins on their own and stuff like that. But then you do... You know, maybe it's popular because you do get these people who like break the mold where, like, famously, you know, Maggie Backstead was like, you know, 6'4 and like 95 kilograms or something like that when he won Paris-Roubaix. And he was just like this big dude. And people were like, oh my God, this is such a large cyclist. Like, and so because there are these trends among body types, I think people can get, you know, really into saying, oh, well, you know, you must be a better classics person because you're that big. And like, well, no.
Look at Michael Matthews. He's really slim and he's a great sprinter.
Exactly.
One of the other things that I remember the first time this actually occurred to me, I was at a crit with a friend of mine, and he's a big dude, and I had never raced with him before, and I was like, oh yeah, man, you got all these leg muscles, like, look at you, like, you must have a 1500 watt sprint. And he's like, I've never broken 1000. I was like, what? and he could just go motor. And that's when I learned that your body type doesn't necessarily tell you what you're good at or not. And this is actually one of the things that I have to talk about with a lot of cyclists who think that my body type is this, therefore I'm good at this. And I'm like, well, your power profile actually says you're good at this. So why don't we try this? And then we, you know, fold that into that whole thing and what they mentally want to do, what they're good at with their strategies and things like that. So then, there's a lot of factors, but yeah, the endomeso ectomorph thing is, it's bullshit.
It's just as good as spot training, which means it's not good.
All right. So question 16, what's the most underrated training tip or strategy most people miss? We actually kind of covered this earlier. Eat well and sleep more.
And, you know, stress, minimizing stress in places that you can, if they're easy, like.
Yeah, that's a big one. Cause I heard, I was watching a Mike Israetel videos recently, and he was talking about how he said a great phrase, the mental stress and the physical stress go into the same box.
Yeah. Your body doesn't know the difference between.
Yeah. The only difference is, well, your muscles know the difference because if you're mentally stressed, you're not going to adapt. You're not getting faster. But it is like gaining acute training load without any training. No matter what your heart rate is, I'm sorry, it's not going to help.
Yeah.
All right. Number 17. I know you're all about the hashtag watts, but do you have thoughts on HRV for measuring fitness? I certainly do. I would say for the general populace, tracking HRV in the long term is associated with better aerobic fitness. Most people who are sedentary don't have great aerobic fitness. And so over the long term, yeah, you're going to see HRV improve, quote unquote improve. But once you get to a certain level of trainedness, HRV actually will respond a lot more to things you're doing off the bike than any level of fitness you can achieve on the bike. So if you drank too much the night before, if you stayed up too late, if you didn't sleep well, like if it was too hot or something like that, or you were on your phone too late, these things will affect your HRV more than the workout you just had. And in fact, a lot of the time when athletes I'm training are tracking their HRV, one of the things that I notice is that probably half of them, their HRV actually improves when they're getting tired because they're also in the middle of training, their body's adapting to this kind of thing. And then the second we give them a rest, their HRV tanks. So kind of the opposite of what you might expect generally, but I'm sure not unheard of.
I would also say
yeah,
it can depend too. Like HRV isn't going to totally override how you feel mentally as a person. If you're exhausted, but your HRV says you're fine. Like if you feel exhausted, like, you know, take it easy. Don't think like, oh, this like little watch I pay $80 a month for, or whatever it is.
Oh, is that how much it is?
No, I don't remember how much it is, but you know, okay. don't think that like $30 a month that you pay to have your HRV strap is going to somehow be better than how you feel as a person who has like a central nervous system.
Yeah. Well, and also I think it gets overinterpreted sometimes because I think what's happening is the general fitness gurus for the lightly trained weekend warrior, you know, person who rides their bike twice a week, that is bleeding over into the into training for actual endurance stuff. And so, I mean, it's not like there's nothing there for sure. Because, you know, I know a lot of people who will see something happen with their HRV and they'll go, oh, I think I might be getting sick. So it's like a clue, or it can be a clue, but also it's not like they didn't notice that they might be getting sick. It's like, I might feel like I'm getting sick. I'll check my HRV. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'm probably getting sick. So now you've got another piece of information to triangulate with.
Yeah. And that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not the only indicator. It is just another indicator.
Definitely. And it's not like you should, you know, train or rest by your performance management chart or something like that. It's kind of like that. Like you need to, like I think I've only seen one paper where they really had people train based on their HRV on the day. And it was one of the most statistically dishonest papers I've seen in a while. So, I would ignore that. I haven't seen actually a really good paper on it since. So if it works for you, well, make it work for you. Don't work for it is what I should probably finalize that with.
That's a good way to put it.
All right. Question 18, is there a benchmark number a cyclist should be shoot for squats, should be shooting for squats? That is the question verbatim, should be shoot for squats. No, there is not. Absolutely not.
Yeah. If there was, that would be nice. Cause you say, oh, just, you know, work up into the off season at whatever Peter Sagan can do. And then you'll win classics and stuff like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, you
know,
you'll
like,
have 1600 watt sprint. And it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's no benchmark. I know a lot of people try to put that out there as a target to hit. And I get why some people do that. But I like to think people understand the nuance a little better because it may get you a lot of clicks. It may sell a lot of whatever you're selling, in order to, to have a list like that. But at the same time, for some people, some people just aren't going to get there. And some people are like already way past it. And does that mean they shouldn't have to do strength training? You know, there's a lot more factors to it, and I don't think that, having a certain, percentage of your body weight as your one rep max squat should be a goal. It should be, do I need to lift? Do I need to be stronger than I am now? Do I need to lift for other reasons? And if the answer is yes, then you should probably lift.
Another way to put it is also that your primary sport is not going to be like one rep max back squats. So like whether you can squat 700 pounds or 70 pounds, that's not the goal. The goal is just to use this training to make you healthier or faster or better. So whatever number you get to in that process, great, but you shouldn't shoot for a goal because unless you're going to compete in powerlifting or something, like max back squat is not relevant to you at all. It's like, you know, I can have this as a fun off season thing, maybe see how much you can get to, but you know, it shouldn't be on your like top 10 list of goals.
Definitely. No, I mean, I remember, with a couple athletes that I train, I never have people, even, you know, sprinters like me and Kyle, like we don't test our one rep max squat. We'll get to like, a 9 out of 10 RPE, something that we can feel as our 2 or 3 rep max, but we'll never go to actual max. Trap bar deadlift, we can do max. Cause if you screw up, you're just not going to break it off the floor. It's not going to like hurt you if you bail out of the lift incorrectly, like can happen in squats. All the Instagram gym fails are just. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
As another point of reference, even Olympic weightlifters a lot of times don't pursue one rep max back squats, and their sport is still on, you know, maximal strength and explosiveness. But they, even for them, going for one rep max back squats, for a lot of them, even the normal size people who can probably still squat, you know, 500-700 pounds, they don't go for them because it's too risky and it's not worth it. And they can go for 5 rep maxes or go for front squat maxes or stuff like that, but they will not try to go for these huge numbers in back squat because it's also not their sport. Like, they don't care.
Yeah, it's a means to an end. But one of the reasons I was starting to bring up trap bar deadlift is that one of my athletes, for instance, actually, and quite a few people, when we get pretty deep into a training block, it actually gets hard for somebody to increase their strength. And at some point, you know, you are going to need to change your training or change your diet in order to get stronger. So if you're really chasing this number, like you are at, you know, for some, not everybody, obviously, but some people are going to have to really, really screw up their endurance training in order to hit this, you know, squat rep max number or something like that, especially if they don't have a lot of muscle mass to begin with. Because, you know, your body doesn't like to put on muscle mass that much unless you're eating a ton. And then, you know, the associated, you know, increase in body fat will be detrimental. Then you'll have to lose that. So it becomes a really long process to get stronger for some people. You know, and that's one of the things we're looking at, you know, an average person should be able to hit this rep max for a squat or a deadlift or whatever it is. You know, it doesn't talk about the bell curve. And some people are going to be well over that. Like, I started my strength training with a back squat that was probably almost 2 times my body weight. So already pretty strong and probably over whatever number somebody might think is good. So does that mean I didn't have to train? Well, if I wanted to, you know, increase my sprint, yeah, I would have had to do more more squatting. But, you know, it's somebody who's not that strong to begin with, you know, do you need to change your training to hit this number? The answer is no, you really don't. All right, last question. Any tips for recovery weeks apart from sleep? I always seem to come back flat. Well, I hope you're not just sleeping. I hope you are riding your bike a little bit.
Yeah, you don't want to just like sit on your couch for a week. Staying in contact with a little bit of activity and maybe like a little bit of intensity, but not like shitload.
Yeah.
You know, like just so you can still feel good, kind of like openers or something, right? Like,
exactly. That's actually one of the reasons I included this is we're kind of getting to that. Because this is one of the questions that I think I've been asked the most on the Instagram Q&A is about this. Like, I'm always not good after a rest week and I have to train for a week to feel good. Like, what's happening? Because I actually knew a couple coaches, maybe they still prescribe stuff like this, but who would say a rest week, you shouldn't even look at your bike. Which is probably not at all the case. You should definitely look at your bike. You should definitely ride it.
Maybe clean it too.
Probably clean it, make sure that all the bolts are tightened. Yeah. So I think, with a recovery week, you definitely want to come out of it feeling refreshed and ready to train hard. But, one of the things that happens during rest is that your body, hormonally, starts to shift into the rest mode too much, which is good. You want that because you want the recovery associated with that. However, it can take some people a little longer to kickstart the engine when they get back to hard training. And Kyle, it's just what you were talking about. Openers are a really good idea when you are done with a rest week to get back to hard training. It can take two or 3 days to do openers too sometimes.
And this also is something that you can experiment with, you know, you as a person, you, if you get assigned a rest week, oh, if last time you did X, Y, and Z and it didn't feel that good, then, you know, try something else. Try adding a little bit more intensity or, you know, I don't know, throw in a fun group ride still or something that keeps you mentally refreshed as well as riding a little bit, not, you know, not necessarily just like 8 days of, you know, Oreos and and sitting.
Yeah. And also I would say as a general guideline on a recovery week, I would say keep it to a 6 out of 10 RPE at the most. So even if it's a kind of aggressive group ride, get yourself to like a 6 out of 10 and then stop. And you know, just roll home easy or just like roll easy for the rest of your ride and just leave the group. I've mentioned this before, but this is one of the only times I will assign like steady state tempo. Is during a rest week. So especially coming out of a rest week, something like 30 to 60 or maybe even a little longer of straight up zone three, you know, at a pace that I know is over somebody's all day pace. You know, I'll even assign it as a wide range, like, you know, 30 to 60 minutes or 30 to 90 minutes. Ride here until your legs are starting to feel toasty and then stop. Because what you're doing is you're starting to get your body used to that working set of hormonal activation again. And it can take a little time. Like, I remember the first time I did I did openers by accident in a race. So I go to a Friday night race. I get my ass handed to me in like 5 laps. I felt awful. I'm pulled. And then Saturday, I did 2 hours of straight endurance. And I felt better at the end of that than I did the Thursday before the race when I was supposed to be feeling nice and fresh because I rested, because my coach at the time, I rested too hard into the race. And, you know, for him, that's good for him, but it didn't work for me. So this is where, you know, some proof that everybody's a little different. And I'm one of those people where I get a lot of what I call rest inertia. I got a ton of it. My body's like, oh yeah, we're on the couch. Yeah, we want to stay on the couch. An object at rest. Well, you know the Newton thing. So
yeah, cookies.
Yeah. And so Sunday, my legs were amazing. And it was one of the first times that I ever noticed that I felt really, really good right after feeling really, really shitty. And it's because I accidentally did openers in a race. And it can be hard stuff. And then a day to recover. And then you've got good legs. So that was the way I like to work. And that's the way I still work on the few times I go to races for myself.
Yeah. I think the other thing is this isn't in the question, but this also can be folded into how do I program an actual big taper for myself? That would also be something that requires some trial and error potentially, and hopefully things that you learn about your body from rest weeks, you can then fold into that in the future.
Yeah, for sure.
Know, just because someone does a 2-week taper and, you know, they said that that was the best. Oh, well, you know, if that doesn't work for you, like, don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, some people do have really good legs after really hard rest. And if you're one of those people, then this is not really a thing that you probably stopped listening to the episode by now. But if you're like me, this is one of the things that you can struggle with. And, you know, looking at how do I optimally get ready for a race. You know, a lot of really, really good endurance athletes, you know, some of them, like for instance, I remember hearing an interview about a guy who did a 5-hour ride the day before starting a stage race. And everybody first thought is, that's a lot of riding. But he said if he didn't ride 5 hours every day, he didn't feel good the next day. So that's just one of those things that he needs. And I coach a couple of people like that where they ride every day, and if they don't, they feel awful. And it's definitely out there. And as long as you control the intensity, you're going to be okay. Yeah. All right, so that is it for the questions. Kyle, do you want to wrap up the show with any thoughts? Maybe thoughts on 2020 itself? Potentially?
2020, it's been a year, right? Oh, man.
It's only been a year?
Yeah. we're going to have to define different eras after this. It'll be like before 2020 and after 2020, because, man, this feels like a different time. But I know it's been weird for probably everyone. Hopefully people are able to take some time and have found good ways to decompress and kind of figure things out. And, you know, hopefully we get back to some more non-virtual racing in 2021. But yeah, man, it's been a year for the record books or the history books or something.
And if you're going to race in 2021, make sure that you follow everybody's safety protocols very strictly.
And we know everyone's getting really antsy, and it's totally understandable. Make smart choices.
Yeah.
Be responsible, please.
Yeah, questionable choices are only for when you're out by yourself in the woods, seeing if you can clean this section of single track on your cross bike.
Yeah. Hopefully you brought a flat kit.
Yeah, ask me how many times I've dented my front rim. Yeah, and also I want to thank everybody for listening. This is not the usual show outro, but for sending in your questions, for interacting on Instagram, for sending me all the nice messages about your improving fitness, and for the coaching inquiries and the consultation inquiries. Empirical Cycling has grown a lot in 2019 and 2020, and I actually thought that I was going to lose a ton of business this year, and it turns out that we grew quite a bit. So thank you for everybody. Thank you for signing up with me for coaching, and thank you for signing up with my assistant coach, Alex. And we may even be hiring new coaches pretty soon. So if you're on a wait list, expect to hear back about that. So everybody, thank you as always. And remember to send a donation, especially the people who donated to the show. Thank you all so much. Honestly, it's way more than we would ever expect with ad revenue, and we don't think that we don't appreciate it.
If you have anything you want to hear about, questions, or things that you have, send them along, because obviously here, your feedback and your questions and comments and stuff get folded right in, so.
Yeah, definitely, and so also watch out for the WKO5 stuff in the next couple of days. Please don't blow me up too hard with all the questions about it. assuming anybody cares at all. I'm assuming they will, but I guess we'll see what happens. All right, so we've got merch, Empirical Cycling Podcast at threadless.com, coaching consultation inquiries, empiricalcycling@gmail.com. If you got any questions or comments, check me out on Instagram at Empirical Cycling for the weekend AMAs. Actually, Kyle, where can people find your cat's Instagram?
Millie's Instagram is silly Millie, MILIE, Michi, MICHI. And then Kelvin is available at Millie, MILIE dot Kelvin. It's a pun, Millie Kelvin.
I never thought about that. That's great.
Millie, MILIE dot Kelvin, KELVIN. So, also, if you like cat photos, it's all cat photos. Cats doing some
thanks
stuff,
God. My Instagram's almost turning into that too. With some
what's the internet for if not for cats?
Apparently it's arguing in bad faith.
Well.
All right, thank you everybody for listening, and we will see you all in 2021 with the metabolism series.
Thanks everyone.